Welcome to Write Now with Scrivener, where writers talk about how they work, how they develop their ideas, and how they use Scrivener, the app built for long-form writing projects. I'm your host, Kirk McElhern, author of Take Control of Scrivener. Today I'm very happy to welcome Todd Henry. Todd Henry defines himself as an arms dealer for the creative revolution. Todd, thank you for joining me.
Kirk, it is so good to be here. And I'm really excited to talk about one of my favorite tools in the world, which I know we're going to get to in a little bit.
Yes, Scrivener. You're a diehard Scrivener user, and we'll get to that in the second part of the podcast. You write, I want to say productivity books. I know that's oversimplifying, right? But this is the sort of category where you'd find it in a bookstore or in Amazon. And I've been a freelancer for more than 25 years. I've read a whole bunch of productivity books. And most of these books tell you how to get more things done. And your message seems to be about how to get things done better.
Yeah, I primarily have focused my work on what I call create on demand professionals. So people who have to go to work, solve problems, write things, design things, come up with ideas, provide solutions on demand. You know, not necessarily the artists who have all the time in the world to make whatever they want, but people who have to go to work and show up with a solution by next Tuesday, whether it's copy or design or a strategy, a solution, a presentation. Because the reality is that requires us to be creative. We have to be creative on demand. The problem is creativity doesn't like to show up whenever we beckon it, that creativity has to be, in some ways, has to be lured. It has to be cultivated. And so I spent most of my early formative years as a creative director and discovered a couple of things that seemed to work pretty well to help people have ideas more consistently. And that was what led to my first book, The Accidental Creative. And really the whole point is, if we want to be brilliant at a moment's notice, if we want to have ideas when we need them, we have to begin far upstream from the moment we need a brilliant idea, which means we have to build practices in our life to prepare us for those moments when we need to be creative under pressure.
In one of your articles on your website, you say, if you're a writer, your everyday habit of writing things you don't always care for is what enables you to write the once in a while 60,000 word book manuscript. It's kind of like you're doing scales, right?
That's exactly right. You know, if you talk to any brilliant musician who has developed their own voice. You know, they think of the most unique, think of Jimi Hendrix, for example, right? Some of the most unique artists who play guitar, the way they started was by imitating other people who play guitar. So, you know, and if you listen to, Paul McCartney talk about how he learned how to play music, he will talk about how he emulated these jazz standards, you know, or how he listened to classical music and learned how to play classical music on the piano or on, you know, the way that we learn any craft is by emulating, by copying other people. And then at some point we discover something unique that we have to bring. That's when we diverge. That's when we innovate and we come up with our own style, our own perspective. But I think the problem is so many people think that they can just leap off into that innovating phase. You know, I want to go out and be a brilliant, unique artist without ever really perfecting their chops, without getting to the point where they just every single day sit down and they write and they crank it out. And some days, I mean, Stephen King said that he copied Combat Casey comic books over and over and over in these little blue books. Like he would just word for word copy them. And it seems like a pointless exercise, but to him, it was internalizing for him what it felt like to write well. You know, and the same with Steve Earle, the great songwriter, said, basically, all I do is rewrite the songs of my heroes until I find my own voice. Right. And so I think that for anyone who wants to write well and write brilliantly, write uniquely, that starts with just having an everyday practice of writing where some days you're going to get to the end of your writing session and say, it's awful, or it sounds derivative, or it sounds just like, you know, what. But it doesn't matter because you're building those muscles. You're developing the stamina to be able to sit down and write on demand. And that's the only way you ever get to the point where you do something unique is by, you know, persistent repetition and developing your voice over time. It just takes time and effort.
For writers, one of the things that they need to do is read a lot. For musicians, they need to listen to music a lot. So in addition to that habit of doing the creation, even if it's as you say, your everyday habit of writing things you don't always care for, it's also exposing yourself to the things that are good. Stephen King with his comics, or Steve Earle listening to the songs he likes, or Bob Dylan. He released that book last year. What is it? The Philosophy of Modern Song, where he talks about all these songs that influenced him. And it's also absorbing the influences and recognizing what there is in those influences that you can convert to your voice.
Absolutely. And one of the mistakes I think a lot of people make is that they only read or study or delve deeply into a specific area of interest that is uniquely attached to their own profession or their own area of interest. We were just talking about Brian Kloss, who wrote the book Fluke right before we started recording. And I had an interview with him for my podcast this week. And he said a lot of the reading that he does outside of his profession is what informs his profession as a political scientist. It's reading fiction. It's reading particle physics. It's reading these other books that create this deep well of resources, these dots that he can connect that give him better insights in his profession. I have a friend who is a brilliant creative director. He's produced things that everybody listening has seen at some point for some of the biggest music artists in the world. And he only reads fiction, even though his primary medium is video. He only reads fiction for inspiration. He doesn't watch other videos. He doesn't, you know, go out and seek inspiration in his competitors. And the reason he does that is because he knows that, you know, fiction really, the theater of fiction takes place in your mind, and what that conjures in his mind is going to give him ideas that he can then apply to his visual medium. And so regardless of what you write about, yes, you have to research your area. Yes, you have to be an expert in what you're writing about if you're writing nonfiction, especially. But my encouragement would be, listen, seek inspiration outside of the confines of your specific area of focus, because most of the non-intuitive leaps, the brilliant connections that you're going to make are going to come from taking something from over here, something from over there, and finding a connection that nobody else has discovered to this point.
You have an article called Alone with Your Thoughts, and I want to quote a paragraph, which I think is just a brilliant idea. About 15 years ago, I heard a friend say that the best practice he'd ever developed was plopping down in a chair first thing in the morning with a notebook and staring at the wall. I thought he was out of his mind until I started doing the same thing. It's amazing how many thoughts pass through your mind, slipping just between the level of your consciousness, simply because you aren't listening for them.
Yeah.
And that idea of allowing the unconscious to surge is something that people have trouble. Most people can't be bored. Most people can't sit and do nothing.
Very true. Most of us are not even aware of what's on our mind because we don't pause long enough to discover what our mind is trying to prompt us with or trying to tell us. We expect ideas to happen in the cracks and crevices of our incredibly frenetic life. That's not the way that creativity works. It's slow emergent, right? It has to emerge over time, very slowly often. A fellow author who lives here in my city, Peter Block, actually, as I was talking to him about the craft of his writing, he said, the biggest part of writing that people don't account for is thinking. It's just sitting around and thinking. It's just allowing your thoughts to surface and allowing those connections to surface. You have no idea what's on your mind until you actually give your mind the time to surface some of those thoughts. And so I think for me, that's why that practice of just sitting and spacing out, and it looks incredibly, this is the deep irony about creativity, right? Is that it looks incredibly unproductive. Because you're just sitting there. What are you doing? Get busy. Go do something. Make something. Go write. Go. And it's like, well, no, I am. There's a great creative director, Gordon McKenzie, who has since passed on, but he wrote a book called Orbiting the Giant Hairball. And in this book, he says, imagine a farmer walking out to a field and shaking his fist at the cows and saying, hey, you lazy cow, stop chewing grass and start making milk, right? Well, that's what the cow is doing by eating and chewing its cud. And then that's how the milk develops. And I think in today's world of hyper-productivity, where we measure efficiency over effectiveness, we don't have a way to account for those quiet moments of just simply thinking, that idea time that we need in order for brilliant insights to emerge. And so the net result is we grasp onto the first solution, we quickly execute, and then we wonder why nothing we ever make fully satisfies us. It's because we don't give ourselves the luxury of process.
And too many businesses want to count productivity, how many tasks someone has completed, rather than evaluating the quality of those tasks. And how many of those tasks lead to positive outcomes and how many lead to negative outcomes? And how much time is lost in meetings? God forbid. I'm glad to be a freelancer. I do have Zoom meetings from time to time, but my days are not full of meetings. It's just that the metrics in business are wrong, aren't they?
I think that it's a both and. We have to measure efficiency because we all love it when paychecks show up on time. We all love it when, you know, our operations are relatively frictionless. And so there's an organizational need that has to be met in order for all of us to have some predictability and stability to be able to do the work. The problem is when we lean one direction over the other and we fail to realize that our job as creative professionals, especially inside of an organization, our job is not to just get the work done. Our job is to produce value for the clients. And so, listen, if I just wanted to sit down, I mean, I've written 7 books now. If I just wanted to sit down and crank out work every day, I probably could have written 50 books by now. Doesn't mean they would be good books because I would just be writing tripe, whatever's on my mind, right? And that's the approach that many of us take in a create on demand world is, listen, I just got to push this off my plate because something else is moving on. And so it takes courage, takes bravery, actually, for leaders of organizations and for creative pros themselves to say, this is what I need. I need to protect the space that I need to be able to produce the work that you're paying me to produce the value you're paying me to produce. Because you're paying me to produce value. You're not paying me to show up every day between 9 o'clock and 5 o'clock. You're paying me to produce value. Well, then I need what it takes for me to be able to produce that value, even if it looks inefficient to you in the moment.
You know, I was thinking, I get a lot of ideas in the shower. And this morning I was thinking about when I'm writing an article, if I do my research the day before I'm writing it, read through things, not necessarily take notes, but read through and get familiar. The next day when I write the article, it's so much easier to write as if my unconscious has worked through the entire issue overnight. And it's leaving the space for things to move around in your brain. I love this story about the Belgian mystery writer, Georges Simenon. Whenever he would write a novel, and he wrote 400 novels in his lifetime, he would go out and walk for a few days and he would just think and he would like go inward, and then he would come back and write a novel in 7 days.
I love that, man.
And these weren't long novels. They were 50,000 words, but still, 7 days to write a 50,000 word novel. He had this process that for him was this interior creation. And when he got to write it, it was as if he was taking dictation from his subconscious.
I love that. Again, we get back to the fact that so much of the process happens beneath the surface and we need to give that its due. You know, there is a time to go clickety clack on the keyboard for sure. I mean, that's part of the discipline some people need to develop is I just need to sit down and crank out words and just see where that leads. And you're not always going to love what you write. Stephen Pressfield, I've had him on our podcast several times. He loves to quote W. Somerset Maugham, who said, somebody asked him, do you only write when you're inspired or do you have a specific time that you write? And he said, I only write when I'm inspired. Fortunately, it happens every single morning at 9 a.m., you know? And I think that there's a lot of truth to that, that we need structure and we need looseness and we need to understand that there's an ebb and flow to creativity. And sometimes we need to just give our process some time to work itself out. And sometimes we need to sit down and just go clickety-clack on the keyboard until something good comes out. And that's just the reality of it. And also, we're also the worst judges of our own work often. You know, sometimes we sit down and produce something and we think, oh, that was the worst thing I've ever done. But the reality is, actually, it was pretty good in retrospect, you know. So we have to also give ourselves some grace in our process.
I'm reminded of another author, Anthony Trollope, who worked for a post office in England in the 19th century. And he would set, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 hours every morning, and when the clock struck, he would stop writing, even if he was in the middle of a sentence. If he finished a novel a half an hour before, he would start the next one and then stop. He would just have this routine, this rhythm. And, you know, those 19th century novels were long. I guess there are some people who can do that, who can just get into the rhythm that they can turn, I don't want to say the muse, but they can turn the subconscious on demand like that and on schedule.
I think that, so I call that ending with the beginning in mind. You've heard begin with the end in mind, but I call it beginning with the ending in mind, or ending with the beginning in mind, which means when I get to 500 words, which is, by the way, my daily word count when I'm working on a book, when I type the 500th word, if I'm in the middle of a sentence, I stop. And thanks to Scrivener, I actually am able to tell when I get to that point. But when I get to 500 words, I stop because I know exactly where I'm going to start the next day. And that's often the hardest thing is where do I start up? If I just write till I'm exhausted, till I've exhausted a thought, then I often don't know where I'm starting the next day. And so, that's actually, I think, a really helpful tip. I think Hemingway actually talked about that, about stopping when you've got some momentum. So that way the next day you have somewhere to start.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how you use Scrivener to write your books. Writing a book, screenplay, or even a long article is a juggling act. You need to find the right words and the right structure, keep track of research, and refer to notes. Tailor-made for long writing projects, Scrivener is the go-to app for writers of all types. Scrivener combines a typewriter, binder, and corkboard in a single app. A project outline makes it easy to get an overview of your work and flip between sections. Refer to research alongside your writing, and just drag and drop to rearrange your work. Write in any order in sections as large or small as you like and let Scrivener stitch it all together when you're ready to share your words with the world. With Scrivener, you'll find everything you need to start writing and keep writing. Scrivener is available for Mac, Windows, iPad, and iPhone. Download the free trial from ScrivenerApp.com. Right now with Scrivener, listeners can get a 20% discount with the coupon code PODCAST. That's ScrivenerApp.com. So you are a big Scrivener fan. You were telling me before the podcast that your first book was not a disaster in terms of the book, but the writing process. And then you discovered Scrivener. Tell me about this.
Yeah. So the book actually turned out great. But I was a first time author. It was 2009. I was writing my first book, The Accidental Creative, which came out in 2011. And nobody had ever taught me how to write a book. And so I had an outline. We'd done the proposal. I'd written a couple sample chapters. So I just sat down and started typing from the introduction. I thought that's what you do, right? Like The Accidental Creative by Todd Henry, and you start typing into a document. And that seemed fine until I realized after a handful of weeks that chapter two was 38,000 words long and my entire manuscript was supposed to be 60,000 words, right? And I realized this is not working for me. I have no way of tracking what I'm doing. I have no way. And also just, Word is a great tool, but like it didn't fit my writing style. I don't think in a linear way, nor do I like to write in a linear way. And so I started doing some research. Like there has to be, somebody has to have solved this problem. And I happened upon Scrivener, and the things that I love about Scrivener, and boy, I have been waiting years to say this to specifically to Literature and Latte, right? But the thing that I love about Scrivener is I can write books from the inside out. I can track exactly how much I've written. So I tend to write books in sections. What section do I feel like writing about today? And it might be in chapter five today. Tomorrow it might be in chapter two. Next week it might be chapter seven, or maybe I'll write three or four sections in chapter two today. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's dependent upon whatever I happen to be wanting to work on that day. And because it's all text files that can be moved around wherever I want, it's easy to track when I'm writing and it's easy to organize when I'm writing in a very streamlined way. I have many times said I can't imagine now writing a book in anything other than Scrivener, just because it so perfectly matches the way that I want to work. And then even, my latest book, The Brave Habit, as I was writing it, there were some footnotes and things, and just the way that Scrivener handles footnotes and handles, all of the sort of the, more the technical side of the craft is just, I think, so elegant. And so that for me, it's a tool that matches my writing style perfectly. And the way that I get ideas into the world the best.
Yeah, it is. As you say, no one's ever said this, writing from the inside out. I like that because you know where you're starting, you know where you want to end, but you don't know which part of a book you're ready to write. And this is less the case with a novel, though often in a novel, you may be thinking about a scene that's two thirds of the way through before you've figured out the beginning. But particularly in nonfiction, you have a number of ideas and you're not sure how to fit them together, what order they go in. So this allows you, this is the perfect example of putting everything down and then deciding how it fits. And your idea of writing 500 words a day is really interesting too. So if you finish a chapter at 400 words, you write 100 words of the next chapter?
I do. Yeah. I keep writing until I get to 500 words. And that's a discipline. And 5 days a week, 500 words, 5 days a week. That's 2,500 words a week. That's a chapter every couple of weeks. If I'm under deadline, that's a manuscript in about 6 months, you know, the reality is I'm writing a 60 to 70,000 word manuscript. I'm going to write probably 90 to 100,000 words to get to that 60 to 70,000 words. So it takes a little longer. So it takes about a year to write a book typically. Once I've done the research and everything else. And that's just my discipline. That's just the way I've done it since 2009 since 2011, I would say that's been my discipline is 500 words a day, every day, because two things. Number one, I don't particularly like writing. It's not what I would prefer to do. But it is the best way to get ideas into the world. So it's the old cliche of I don't love writing, but I love having written. That's very much what it feels like to me. And so for me, that's a way for me to get enough work done without completely exhausting myself. Some people write 1,000 words a day. That's great. I've tried that. And by the end, I'm like, I never want to write again. Right. So 500 words to me feels like it's enough to get an idea out, enough to have some momentum, but not enough to exhaust me. And I mean, again, I've written 7 books in 13 years, you know, 7 nonfiction books in 13 years, including research and everything else that went into them. And so far it's been a process that's worked well for me.
You're, among other things, a professional speaker. Have you ever tried dictating?
I've not. And what I've discovered is that the way that I think when I speak is very different from the way that I think when I write. And so the net result for me often when I'm speaking, I'm speaking in colloquial language. I'm trying to get rapport with people. I'm trying to, you know, bring them in on an idea. When I'm writing, often my thought process is building an argument. I'm trying to build an argument to get people to a certain place. And that's a very different way of, it's a different thought process. So I tried it and it doesn't work for me. I've even tried transcribing some of our podcast episodes, thinking I could turn those into, you know, what I've discovered is that it actually works better if I write it and then I use it as a podcast episode, like then if I try to do a podcast episode and then, you know, and then transcribe it. So it's not really worked for me. I know for some people it works well, but to me, it doesn't match my writing style very well when I try to do that.
I've been dictating for, I want to say 25 years with the caveat that software back in the old day was bad. I worked for many years as a translator and dictated into a dictaphone and someone would type it up. This is when you're translating someone else's words, so you're not creating the argument, right? I don't know if you're a Mac user or a Windows user, but on Mac OS, the built-in dictation is so good that I can dictate articles. Now, I wouldn't be able to dictate a whole book, but a 1,000-word article where you know the arc of your argument, I find it relatively easy to dictate most of it like that. It's good for the posture because you're not leaning over the keyboard. It's a different way. I find a different way of thinking. And there's a lot more revision, I would say, when I dictate than when I type.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And the tools have, like you said, they've advanced so much now at this point. Even then we were talking about your podcasting tools and transcription tools and all of that. I mean, just what is available now with AI, generative AI, and some of the tools that we have at our disposal. I think that writing is going to look very different 5 years from now than it does right now, because I think that we're going to have these little assistants that know us, that are saying, hey, this seems like something you've written about before. Here are a couple of other ideas you've had. Do you want to, you know, pull in one of those? Or, you know, we're going to have all of these tools kind of almost like little gremlins sitting on our shoulder, you know, whispering in our ear all the time. And so I think to that effect, things like dictating, where I can dictate something and it knows my voice and it takes what I say and it turns it into my writing style. I think that's going to be that will happen in the next couple of years for sure. It may already exist. Something that takes colloquial language and turns it into something that feels more like not the King's English, but you know what I'm saying? Like something that's a little more,
sounds more businessy.
Sounds more businessy. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that exists already with ChatGPT. I've been telling people for a while now that I want to be able to create a database of the thousands of articles I've written and dump them into a large language model, which would be my personal GPT that would write articles in my style. Now, someone told me recently that we're getting there, that if you can, if you can put the text together the right way, we're almost there. And that to me would be, I want that on my computer, on my iMac, that sort of thing. I want something to take my style, not the GPT style, which is wooden and sounds like bad undergraduate writing.
Right. Yeah. So that does exist now. You can create an LLM of your own content, of your own material. What we're doing, I've just completely reinvented our podcast after 18 years. We've been podcasting since 2005, I think like 3,500 episodes. And we just completely eliminated those, started over with season one, episode one on January 1st of 2024 under the new name Daily Creative with Todd Henry. But what we've done is taken all of those old episodes, those old interviews, everything we've done for the last 18 years, and we're putting them in an AI, with transcriptions and everything else so that we can basically just ask the AI questions. Have we ever had anybody on who talked about such and such, Scrivener or whatever, we can ask questions and it'll come back with transcripts, quotes, other elements. And then we can pull those into new episodes because, why wouldn't I want to use an episode from 2013 with Simon Sinek or Seth Godin or whoever, and pull it into an episode today because it's still relevant, still good content, right? So again, these tools that we have at our disposal are incredible. I will say one of the things I love about Scrivener, not to kind of take us back there, but I always operate in full screen mode. I'm always writing with black screen with white text. And part of what I love about that is there's none of the complexity of like the distractions, the tools, when I'm writing, I want to be writing. That's what I want to be doing. I don't want to be, glancing down at my email. I don't want to be, looking at my research. I just want to be writing. I want to be in writing mode when I'm writing. And that's one of the, often my kids would walk into my office and they'll just see like a black screen with white text. When they were younger, they'd say, "Why is your computer so boring?" And I'm like, "Well, because this is what daddy does, right? Like I'm focused on doing the thing I do." And it's a valuable to have a tool that does that, but it's also just a valuable skill to develop, to be able to just do that deep dive,
block everything out.
Yes. What Cal Newport calls deep work, right? Like to be able to do that is really valuable.
That's called composition mode. And I'll link in the show notes to an article on the Scrivener blog discussing that for anyone who doesn't know it. It is an incredibly powerful tool. You just one click and everything is gone. And that complicated desktop with files and folders and email, like you say, and messages, it all disappears. It's still there in the background, but it does let the brain focus more on what you're doing. I just want to go back to one thing you were talking about earlier. You're saying that people write things and then they think it's no good. And a lot of writing involves hesitation and not trusting that what you write is good enough. How can we get over that? Because, you've written 7 books. I've written 1,000 articles. There are strategies to stop thinking that our writing isn't any good.
So I would say two things about that. The first is, if you are the president of the United States making a speech about foreign policy that could drastically impact the arc of world history, you have to be very careful about what you say. If you're typing, if you're on clickety-clack into Scrivener, you can write anything you want because there's this magical thing that I discovered called editing that you can do where you go back and you can actually say that was really dumb and you can erase it after some thought. So that's number one is listen, the drafting process, it's what I think Anne Lamott calls, and I'm not going to say the word, but the crappy first draft, right? You just listen, just push it out. Just your only job is just to push it out on paper and realize the shaping, the hardest part of writing a book, by far the hardest part is the editorial process. I've had some brilliant editors at Penguin Random House. Nikki Papadopoulos came to me after my fourth book. The draft was, I thought, pretty locked after we'd been through some editorial. And she said, "We're dropping chapter 6. And I was like, I spent weeks on chapter six, but you know, that's what a brilliant editor will do is they'll say, listen, this is redundant. We're going to pull some scraps and we're going to put them in other parts, which again, with Scrivener was so easy because I had these little text files. I could just move them around. But she said, but the chapter's redundant. We have to suspend our judgment in the drafting process. And then we have to become hypercritical in the editorial process. We have to be really hard on ourselves in the editorial process and really easy on ourselves in the drafting process. Some of the best ideas in my books came as a result of things I didn't mean to write and I thought were silly at the time. And then I realized, oh, this is an insight that it's not mature yet, but this is actually an insight that needs to be developed. And so we have to give ourselves that luxury.
Okay. I like to ask my guests if they have a book that they can recommend to our listeners, not one of your books, but something you've read recently or one of your favorite books.
Yeah. So, I'll recommend, it's funny. I've been recommending this book all over the place, but, Born Standing Up by Steve Martin. It's his autobiography of his time as a stand-up comic. The reason I love it is because for anybody creative, it walks through how he discovered his voice as an artist. He talks about the importance of naivete, especially early on when you're first learning. Steve Martin, for those who don't know, was a brilliant stand-up comic who was filling arenas back in the 70s and quit at the height of his fame, quit stand-up comedy to go write novels and do movies. And then he quit that to take up banjo and he won a Grammy as a bluegrass artist, right? And so here's a guy who's done all these amazing creative things, but this book is about the beginning of his life as a stand-up comic and how he discovered his passion and his voice. And it's definitely worth reading for anybody who's in a creative field.
Todd Henry, arms dealer for the creative revolution. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much.
If you like the podcast, please follow it in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. To learn more about Scrivener, go to scrivenerapp.com. Join us next month for another conversation on Right Now with Scrivener.